British Spy Stories, Season 2, The Kill Order. Episode 27. Panama stands in the shower for longer than usual, then gets dressed and goes out into the March night. He walks from his flat and through the city centre, a place he has known for all of his life. The wind picks up as his route takes him beyond the busy shopping streets and into the residential roads of the Frunziensky district of Minsk. He reaches the Hotel Panamarenki and takes the lift to the bar near the top of the building. He orders beer and finds a table for six near the window that allows a wide view of the tower blocks sprouting up from amongst the trees for as far as the eye can see. From behind him, he hears the voices of his oldest friends as they emerge from the lift. Panama turns, and the old gang from his school days, Felix, Olney, and Deonte, see him at the same time. They all hug and order more beers. Panama has lost count of the number of beers he's had. By the time two men from the next table start to swap jokes that they've heard, and a larger group forms into a drinking community. The men are not Belarusian, but Serbian, and are up on a building contract. They're friendly and get good money with their jobs, so pay for more rounds than the four friends. Luka, one of the Serbians, is a showman and leads the group on different things to talk about and has lots of jokes. By the time it's nearly midnight, Panama has had more drink than he's had in a long time. Luka has arranged a taxi for them all, so they all go down to the ground floor. But it turns out that one taxi can only take four people, so Luka orders another one, and he and Panama will take the second one. In the taxi, they're yet talking. Luka is thinking of buying a place in Minsk, and is it a good place to live? Panama says he's lived here all his life and has a flat in the centre, but is staying out of town, in a family house in the forest at the moment. Luka is fascinated, and says how good it must be to have a second place to get away to. He asks Panama if he has pictures of the house, and Panama shows what is on his phone from years ago, when he went as a child. Luka says he's loved to see the place, and is it far from the city? And Panama shows him the map on his phone, where the place is. And Luka is very impressed. The taxi drops off Panama at his flat, and he watches the taillights of the taxi disappear off round the corner. Once inside, he realizes how drunk he is, so turns on the shower to cold and puts his head under the stream for 5 minutes, until he starts to feel vaguely logical again inside his head. He picks up his phone and dials a number.
Vita,
says Gabby from the earpiece.
Did you have a good evening?
The trap has been triggered, he says.
You need to get back here.
I'm drunk. I'll be there at dawn.
He can hear her breathe out.
Are they coming?
He says.
If I were Barbu, I'd attack immediately.
Gabby ends the call and joins hands on lookout duty. He continues to look down the driveway as she tells him what has happened.
We need to be on high alert, Gordon,
she says. But he's distracted.
Did you hear me? Barbara will be here in 24 hours.
Gab, there's someone out there. Look,
he says. Gabby picks up another set of binoculars and focuses the view on the road outside.
End of the roadway, just under the tree cover, he says. One person, walking.
Could be a trap. Let's go and see, but be very careful.
The two of them walk down through the house and out to the grounds. Hans crosses over to the other side of the driveway, and they move at pace in parallel and draw their handguns. The figure is in shadow ahead of them, striding out towards the house. Gabby indicates to Hans for them to walk on further. And a minute later, Gabby can see him in the undergrowth on the other side of the road. On her signal, they emerge from the bushes simultaneously.
"Put your hands where we can see them,"
she calls to the intruder.
"Gabby, it's me, Laravel."
Everyone relaxes and laughs because of the breaking of stress.
"How's Morrison?"
says Gabby.
"He's scared, to be honest. I don't think he realised how much danger he was in. The Germans are taking it on. We'll get him back to London. So, what are we doing here?"
"Babu's son and the boy's mother are in this house at the end of the driveway.
It's a trap.
Panama went out tonight and lit the blue touch paper. Babu will know this location within a few hours."
"How many of us are there to defend it?"
"Four."
"Fuck,"
says Laravel.
"I trust you, Gab, but you know what you're doing?"
"It'll all work out," says Gabby.
"But I can't get hold of Kate, so you're our sniper."
They all start to walk up the driveway to the house. The moon floods blue light across the trees and their faces as Gabby tells Laravel more about the plan.
"Hello, beautiful," says Carling, as Freya comes into the room and sits next to him on the sofa so their legs are touching. She puts her head on his shoulder. After a few moments, she says,
"Will you be staying in Copenhagen now your sister has found the professor?"
"I don't know."
"Why don't you know?"
Freya sits up and looks at him, with concern spread across her features. Carling shrugs.
"You need to care more, Francis,"
she says.
"You're a good man, but you don't seem to give a stuff about anything."
"I care about you."
"If we're going to make this work, you need to open up more."
She holds his hand, and he can feel the warmth of her skin.
"Look," he says, "I haven't been totally honest with you."
"If you tell me you're fucking married..."
"No, nothing like that. I don't work in a lab with Morrison."
"What do you do?"
"I work for a security company," he says. "I go where they tell me. It's not always in my control, so I can't promise I'll stay. I could be sent somewhere else tomorrow."
Freya stands and goes to the window and looks out with her back to Carling.
"What are you thinking?"
"About my career."
"Is there always a problem?"
"No. Just getting used to it."
She looks at her watch.
"I'm on shift in an hour. I better go."
"We'll be okay, won't we?" he says.
A slight smile appears on her face.
"Yes, we will."
She goes to the bedroom and reappears at the door to the lounge in her coat.
"I'll see you in the morning, Francis,"
she says, and blows him a kiss. Freya walks to her flat, which is on the way to the hospital. She dumps her coat and walks over to a laptop that is on the dining room table. She fires it up and logs in, then goes into an application that's hidden somewhere on the hard drive. And she starts to type in Russian.
"Daily report. Contact with Agent Carling is going well. I will continue to build the relationship and we can start to turn him into a useful source of information within British intelligence."
She hits return, turns off the machine, and goes to change into her scrubs for the start of her shift. For the second time in 2 days, Marcus regains consciousness and realizes he's somewhere he doesn't recognize. This time the pain is greater than before, and a large area of his scalp is throbbing. He raises his head to see that he's lying in a pool of water inside a large storage room. The walls are not solid, but are made up of wooden planks that have gaps between them, so the brightness from arc lamps outside strikes the floor regularly, creating stripes of light and dark. He doesn't know the time, but he can see that it's night outside. He walks to the wall and pushes an eyeball against a gap to look outside. But the intensity of the glare from the arc lamps stops him seeing anything beyond a concrete roadway before the darkness takes over. He starts to look for a way out of the place. Marcus scans his immediate surroundings, Shelves of what looked like cooking oil are stacked up behind him, almost to the ceiling. There are large doors in the center of one wall, but they are chained shut. He tugs at the chain, but it's solid. He needs to find another way out. Marcus looks up at the towering shelves. If he can topple them against the doors, they may do enough damage for him to make his escape. He starts to kick at one of the supporting legs. After 30 seconds, he can feel some movement. After another minute, the shelving support has a definite kink in it, as his boot continues to batter blows against the steel. Very slowly, the bottles show signs of moving as the framework starts to buckle. Then, it all happens very quickly. The leg collapses outwards. The steel above the leg is pushed out and the bottles of oil start their descent to earth. In less than 2 seconds, the shelves collapse and some bottles split, sending oil clouds spinning off into the room. He has to run to dodge the falling framework and falls clumsily onto the concrete floor. The main bulk of the steelwork crashes against the wall near the doors. The sound wave comes next, and then the echo from the walls of the room. After that, only peace. He mentally checks his body for pain. There's nothing more than before. Marcus tries to move, and his leg is caught under a part of the framework. He twists his leg, and gradually it comes free. And he crawls along the floor through the dust and the oil puddles, then stands and walks to the half-broken doors. There's a hole which is big enough for him to climb through. Once outside, he surveys the scene. He is in some sort of industrial estate. The night sky domes black over his head. No stars are visible, and the air has a chill. Marcus walks along what seems to be the exit route to the access road. The first time he sees the cars coming in his direction is as he turns the last corner before the access road joins the main highway up ahead. One black van and a large SUV steam off the road and into the estate. Both have their headlights on full beam, and he's caught in their glare before he has a chance to find cover. Too late, he starts to run to the left, into the waste ground, to one side of the concrete roadway. He can hear men shouting behind him. Marcus tries to quicken his pace, but the ground becomes uneven, and he stumbles more than once before standing again and resuming his run. He reaches a line of fencing and runs along its length, searching for breaks or holes. There is a section that has become loose from children or animals pushing through, and he grabs the wires, trying to make a gap large enough for his escape. He is tired, and the work takes longer than he thought it would. He can feel his adrenaline peaking inside him, and his palms sweating, as the shouts of the men get louder and closer. Marcus finally gets enough space to go through, and throws his body through the hole in the fence. But he is too late, as two large hands grab him and haul him back, then throw him to the ground. He fights back. The man comes back at him and tries to pull his arms behind his back. Marcus kicks the man's legs behind his knees, and the guy collapses but recovers. Finally, Marcus feels the force of a fist on his cheek and the ground coming up to meet his head as he falls. The man pulls his arms again and clicks handcuffs onto Marcus's wrists.
"Secure, chief," says the man,
and roughly sits Marcus up on the ground. The shadow of a man walks towards him, and he looks up at the man's face.
"Marcus," says Sir Bernard, "London Control have been tracking you. They saw you brought here. We arrested two people driving away 5 minutes ago. You've a whole lot of explaining to do, man."
"They trapped me, sir."
His voice is weak.
"You've gone too far this time, Marcus. We found a young woman in the room in Soho. She was dead, We found your DNA on her, Marcus. You can't continue in the service after this.
But, sir...
It's over, Marcus. Take him away, Sergeant.